Grow Great, an entrepreneurial leadership podcast. You are listening to episode 334. They know how to listen. Leveraging the power of others through horrific grief. Greetings and welcome inside the Yellow Studio. I'm glad that you clicked play. I hope you are a subscriber. I'd love it if you'd leave me a 5-star. No, I don't want a 4-star. I want 5-star reviews at iTunes and anywhere else that podcasts can be heard. A few years ago, I stumbled onto a group, a nonprofit that's based in Cincinnati, Ohio. And it wasn't because I was qualified to join their ranks, but it was because I had read some heartbreaking story of a father whose daughter was murdered, and his pain was obvious in the article, and he mentioned how people disappeared on him in his darkest moments. He didn't judge them. He kind of understood how people simply didn't know what to do, didn't know what to say, but he found an organization that was helping him through his grief. Well, as you might imagine, I went down the rabbit hole of searching more articles about this organization, this nonprofit taking on this enormous, heart-wrenching challenge. There were a few articles, but, you know, it's not like finding articles about organizations that are helping cancer victims or heart attack. But, you know, you can find thousands and thousands of online articles about such things, as well you should. But I knew this was a group. And the articles were so sparse. I just knew that they likely understood victimization at an even deeper level, a more judgmental level. This was a group that was serving people with a special kind of a stigma, people who continued to suffer blow after blow long after the news of the murder of their loved one had hit their front door. But over and over again, a truth was expressed in each article, a truth about this organization that thankfully I was not and am not qualified to join. They know how to listen. They know how to listen. You've heard me repeatedly say that judgment is easy, but understanding is hard, mostly because we struggle to listen for understanding. It's just much easier to listen for judgment. And I suppose it can make all of us feel better about ourselves, but it's not helpful. It doesn't help us. It doesn't help others. There's a better way. There is a much, much better way. And that's to lean on each other, especially others with whom we share some context. And in this case, the context is very specific. It's very tragic. Survivors who have lost a family member or a friend to murder. Today's episode is going to be longer than normal because I'm bringing to you a recorded conversation. And this conversation took place just last week. And the conversation went over the span of not quite half an hour. So you may have to listen to today's episode in multiple sessions, but that's okay. It will be worth your while, I promise you. I guarantee it. I don't make many guarantees, but I'm going to guarantee that. They are the nonprofit known as the National Organization of Parents of Murdered Children, Inc. They are a 501c3 organization out of Cincinnati, Ohio, and their tagline tells you exactly what they do and who they serve. For the family and friends of those who have died by violence. Now, if anybody understands the power of leveraging the power of others, I have thought for the last 4 or 5 years since these fine folks came onto my radar, surely it's these people. And so a few weeks ago, I reached out for the first time ever to Bev Warnock. Bev is the National Executive Director. We talked on the phone, we exchanged a few emails, and I asked her if she would let me record a conversation so that I could bring it here to the podcast. I wanted you to benefit from hearing how they have effectively leveraged the power of others through support group chapters around the country. And Bev was very kind and gracious to accept. And she said, we need to have Sherry on with us. And I said, okay, who is Sherry? She said, Sherry Nolan is the other person here in the office. There are only two of us who are employed full-time here. And she is the volunteer coordinator at the national office here with me. And unlike me, she is a survivor. Her daughter was murdered in 2001. And I said, by all means, let's have Sherry join us. And so they were able to join us. You will hear her tell her story in our conversation. What you will not hear is you will not hear her tell, because I didn't find this out until after our recorded conversation, when Bev told me that what you don't know is that her daughter disappeared on Friday, September the 7th, 2001. 4 days later, on Monday, September the 10th, authorities found her body. She was pregnant, violently beaten to death while sleeping by her own husband of almost 2 years. And the next day, well, you know what the next day was in 2001, in September, September the 11th. Sherry and her family's tragedy was now overshadowed by this international event. And that's worth mentioning because of how it negatively impacted Sherry and her family and their ability to have all those people who wanted to mourn the passing of her daughter and her unborn child. Many people were unable to attend simply because of the timing. Murder and violence, they don't much care about convenience, and they don't much care about timing. Who you surround yourself with matters. I would tell you to enjoy the conversation, but more importantly, I would ask you to listen carefully to the conversation. And while your heart is going to go out to the work that these fine ladies do and the other people in the organization, the countless volunteers around the country, I want you to think about how you can leverage the power of others in your own life. We have Bev Warnock and we have Sherry Nolan from Parents of Murdered Children, a 501c3 organization in Cincinnati, Ohio. And Bev, kick us off here. Just give my audience some context of you and your work with the organization and any history, if you care to, about the organization.
Okay. Parents of Murdered Children started in 1978 when a Cincinnati couple, their 19-year-old daughter, went to Germany as a foreign exchange student, and her ex-boyfriend followed her over there and tried to get back with her, and she refused, and so he killed her, beat her with a hammer. She lived for a few days while the parents could get over there, and then when he was convicted and served 18 months in prison, they called it a crime of passion at that time. The family came back to Cincinnati and just couldn't get back to normal. They were devastated. They were grieving. So Charlotte Hollinger, the mother, she contacted a Catholic priest at the time, Father Ken Zillinger, and told him she needed help. He set her up with three other families who had also had someone murdered, and they met in her living room on a Saturday evening. And from those four families meeting, Parents of Murdered Children has grown now 41 years later, to an organization with probably about 100,000 members. Unfortunately, it keeps growing. We try all the time to hope the violence will stop, but it just isn't. But our main purpose here at Parents of Murdered Children is to help families with the aftermath of murder, help them emotionally get back to a normal life, try to feel like they can live again when they're so devastated with the violence of the murder of their loved one. It's just really hard to function again. Some of them can't work. Some of them turn to other substance abuse. It's just an emotionally difficult time. They have to go through the criminal justice system, and they're totally have no idea how to handle that. So our purpose here is to help them with all of those things that happen after the murder of their loved one. We start chapters. We have about 48 chapters around the United States. We have contact persons also in different states. So if a family will call us, we can refer those families to a chapter in their area so they can start to begin building their new life by talking to other families And it's so important for them to be with other families that know what they're feeling, know the problems they're having of how to function again, how to get their life back to normal. And that's our main purpose, is just the emotional support. We don't try to change laws. We don't do any kind of legislation. We just strictly are here for emotional support. One of our big functions we have in the summer is a conference, and we hold the conference yearly around the different parts of the United States. So it gives everybody the opportunity to attend. The conference is there for the families to come, to be with families from all over. They make new friends. They go to workshops, get some education, get some coping skills, and just all around weekend of hope and healing, which is what we want for them to be able to do.
The size of an average chapter, if there is such a thing, I mean, like, how many people are we talking about who meet in these chapters?
Well, some of our chapters are larger than others. So I guess the average chapter is probably maybe about 20 to 30 people that may attend monthly. Some chapters only have two or three people, but our philosophy is we can help one person, then we feel like we've, you know, done what we need to do.
Sure.
So it doesn't matter if they have, you know, one person coming a month or 30 people. But we do have chapters that, you know, are quite large and hold three or four meetings in the area because the area is large. So they'll have a west side and an east side chapter. So, you know, that gives people the ability to travel, not have to travel so far, and be able to attend a chapter meeting.
Now, I know you have extensive experience in facilitating and even training. So what does that look like at a chapter level? Who leads these conversations?
Well, I'm going to let Sherry talk about that because she's the National Volunteer Coordinator here in the national office. But she also is the chapter leader for the Greater Cincinnati Area Chapter. She has monthly meetings, so she firsthand knows, you know, how the meetings go, what happens, and I'll let her talk about that.
All right, and Sherry, before you do that, because I know that you, unlike Bev, you're a survivor of this, and so you have your own story, and I certainly don't want to pry and be overly personal, but whatever story you care to share to just give our audience some context, please feel free.
Okay. My the beginnings of me to become part of Parents of Murdered Children was on September 7th of 2001. My daughter went missing. Her name is Shanna Marie Nolan Rowe. Shanna was 5 months pregnant with her daughter, Alexandra Jordan, and they just went missing. You hear this so many times where people just literally go missing and never found again, or sometimes they are found. In our case, she was missing for 4 days. They were both missing for 4 days. When they were found, it turned out that Shannon's husband, who had actually been her first and only boyfriend, they dated for 8 years, they were married, and then 1 month shy of their second anniversary is when Shannon went missing. But when they were found, it turned out that Shannon's husband had beaten Shannon to death with a baseball bat while she slept in their home. He had removed her and her daughter's bodies from the home, cleaned up what was the evidence that would have been left behind, and then he took them in his car and drove them several miles from his home and buried them in a location off of I-71 in Cincinnati. He came back to their house, from what we understand later, and was able to clean up as much evidence as possible. Some of the reason behind how he was able to do it was because he had a degree in criminal justice, so he himself thought to himself that he knew how to commit the perfect murder. After they were found, after 4 days of searching with sometimes up to 100 people a day, searching the areas in Cincinnati that we thought Shannon may have gone to. Once the police were able to pin John Breaux down to talk to him and found out that he actually was lying when he was taking a polygraph test, he finally gave them a location of where their bodies could be found. He did not say that he was admitting to guilt as far as murder. He just said that he was going to give them the location where the bodies could be found. on the fortunate end for us as a family, we were able to secure not only the arrest of John Brough, but the conviction and the sentencing of the murder of our daughter and our unborn granddaughter. He was tried and convicted and sentenced to aggravated murder for my daughter Shannon and was given a sentence of 20 years to life. He was also convicted of aggravated murder for the murder of my unborn grandchild. This was previous to the Unborn Victims of Violence Act being passed, so the conviction stands on the wording of the unlawful termination of Shannon's pregnancy rather than the wording the murder of a child. And then he was also convicted of tampering with evidence. So his initial sentence was 20 years to life for my daughter, 20 years to life for my unborn granddaughter, and 5 years for tampering with evidence. The tampering with evidence charges were dropped after his first appeal. And the reasoning behind that, which is not a proper reasoning for us as a family, but their reasoning in the court system was that it was too harsh of a punishment for a first-time offender. For us, take into consideration that he not only murdered his wife and murdered his child and buried them, but to the system, it said this was too harsh of a punishment. So he is serving time in Ohio. His first possibility of even asking for a parole would be in 2041. And our goal as a family is to live to see the day that we can stand in front of a parole board and object to his coming back out into society.
Well, I'm obviously horribly moved, but sympathetic and sad for your loss, and realize that you are one of, sadly, thousands and thousands of people who have endured this. That experience and sadly that qualification, talk to me now about at a meeting level and the facilitation, and as these people come in, give our audience some sense of what that may look or sound like.
Okay. Well, I was actually at the first support group meeting for myself within the first 2 weeks after their murders. So I experienced, you know, what it was like to be around other families. The fear of walking in the door, thinking you're the only person on this earth that this could have happened to, and then realizing that you're in a room full of other families who've been devastated by the violence of a loved one. And because of that first meeting and being able to be around other families and honestly, to be inspired by other families, I ended up becoming an advocate myself. And I've been leading the Greater Cincinnati Area Chapter for several years now. Been involved with Parents of Murdered Children in the national office since 2008 as the National Volunteer Coordinator. And then, you know, been helping families open chapters across the U.S. As far as the support group meeting itself, it is a confidential meeting. The information for how to get to the meeting is on our website, and there's a way of contacting the chapter leader and co-leader of that meeting if a family wants to contact us to feel a little bit more comfortable in joining us and understanding what the meeting will be about. The support group meetings are for anyone 18 years and older who have lost a loved one to violence. It could be parent, grandparent, aunt, uncle, siblings, coworkers. And so once they come to a support group meeting, they will be welcomed at the door. We do have a sign-in sheet so that we know who's come to the meeting. Sometimes we have families who are not comfortable coming on their own, and maybe a victim advocate or a counselor that they've been speaking with has brought them to the support group meeting. So we do talk to the quote-unquote non-survivor to make sure that they understand the confidentiality of the meeting as well. The meetings are held very informally. We usually sit in a circle. We take a few minutes to introduce ourselves to one another. And usually if we have a new family coming for the first time, the current membership will speak first. We'll go in a circle, just very short version of who we are and why we're there. And then when it comes time to the family who's just coming for the first time. If they're comfortable, they may speak and say why they're there. And other times, you'll see that they may break down completely and just shake their head and choose not to speak yet. But I think the majority of, you know, support group meetings, as you hear other families speaking about their loved ones, speaking about the things they have encountered, whether it be through the police department, the justice system itself, court system, whether they had a trial or they're still waiting for trial, if there's been an arrest and maybe there's not been an arrest. But hearing all those different stories from other families usually draws such a connection to that person coming in for the first time that they realize that they're in a safe place. They realize they're in a place that they want, that the people in that room want to hear what they have to say and are truly empathetic and understanding of why they're there. We may not say that we know exactly how you feel, but what we can say is we understand the pain and the grief of losing someone to violence that we've loved. I may know a lot of families who've had family members murdered, and I understand their grief and I understand their pain, but I did not know their loved ones, so I don't understand fully the loss that they have. And I think that would be in any circumstance, that unless you know that individual who's been taken from us, who died, you don't truly understand completely their loss because of the special association that they have with their loved ones.
Is there something, Sherry, that you have learned through the years from, and I'm thinking mostly in terms of facilitation, in order to continue to make this a safe space and make this the most profitable meeting that you can make? Is there anything specific that maybe that you have learned or that you have felt, okay, we might be better served to do this more, or any changes in just the facilitation? I'm just curious what your experience has been.
Yeah, we usually have some guideline as to how we're going to facilitate, but we have to be ready to change as per the moment because of the fact that we may have a survivor coming for the first time that we weren't expecting. We may have current membership who comes every month, and all of a sudden there's been a change for them. And that, so we leave the sharing up to what the families need for that month. We may find that some families are not speaking that month, that they're very quiet. And you may find that maybe it's what we call landmine day for them. It may be anniversary date that's bringing something up to them that they're not even able to speak that month. On the other hand, you may have others who feel like they could speak the entire support group setting. We try to make sure that no one monopolizes the meeting, but we also try to make sure that we're very cautious in how we ask for someone to maybe allow someone else to share. One thing that we know as survivors ourselves is there's so much taken from us. Once our loved ones are, there's so much that we had been comfortable with, maybe speaking about our own feelings, and now all of a sudden we're being judged on the fact that we either cry too much or don't cry enough. We're angry, and why should we be so angry, and what gives us the right to be angry, or we're just the different emotions that we're going through. So in the meeting, we want to make sure that all the families understand that there is no judgment in the room, that we are to feel exactly how we need to at that moment. And I think the biggest thing that a support group with parents of murdered children is the openness, the feeling of trust in that room. Something that we do find, and it's universal, that we lose so many other family and friends that were always close to us until the murder happens. They may be there with us through the funeral. They may have even helped us search for our loved ones. But there comes a time, and sometimes it's a very short period of time, where you lose family and friends.
Why is that?
They, honestly, sometimes it's the word is said that we are contagious. That if something so evil touches our lives, that maybe they should stay away because it may touch theirs as well. That our loved ones, in their words, probably did something to bring this upon themselves. Not true. But it's the judgment of others. And a lot of times they cannot handle the journey that we're on.
Right.
They don't know how to speak to us without either making us cry or making us say something they're not capable of listening to.
Sure.
They forget that we want to hear our loved one's name. Instead, sometimes they stop bringing up our loved ones. They put their photos away because for them it's more comfortable to live live their life, never remembering that our loved ones even existed, because it's more comfortable for them. So I think it's just in that group setting, everyone in that room, whether we've known each other or not, until we met in that room, we want to hear what everyone else has to say. We listen very intently because we may not have known your loved one when you walked in the room, but we will know your loved one within, if not that first meeting, within each moment that we're together, and we share more memories. We become what we call POMC family, and we definitely become very close to one another. So we end up standing in for that blood family that may have left us.
And I would assume that both the speaking and the listening are both cathartic.
Absolutely. Because sometimes we have spouses that don't come with their spouse. Maybe a husband or a wife comes separately because at home they can't speak about their child, maybe, who's been murdered. Maybe there's so much statistically for divorce when there's been a child murder, specifically more than any other loved one, because of the not being able to speak to one another. Maybe mom is taking it on a different emotional ride than father is. And it's not to say that just the moms are emotional. Sometimes fathers take it even harder than the moms do, and the moms gain a little bit of more strength and start fighting the system to get, they want justice.
Right.
It really depends individually as family how you go through this trauma together or separately.
Talk to me about the connections that are made that may transcend the meeting, the actual meeting. I'm assuming that many of these people have significant contact even outside the meeting.
Yes. Even though we have them sign a sign-in sheet when they come into the support group meeting, that is not shared. That
right.
is just information that we need for the organization. So what we do is we let the families know that anything they want to share, they can do that amongst themselves. A lot of them connect with each other individually by phone, by email, on Facebook. Some of them are on open Facebook with other members across the U.S., and others keep a private Facebook setting so that it's just between the two of them.
Right.
They may, have dinners together. They meet at their home individually. I know a lot of times it's hard. We always say the hardest thing to do is walk in that room for the first time, but I can tell you that they don't want to leave when the meeting's over. We try to keep to for us, it's a 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. meeting. But a lot of times at 9 p.m. when we actually officially say that we need to say our goodnight, we may hold our circle and have our closing for each individual. But then there are a lot of families who stay behind and still have the need to stay a little bit longer because they know that when they leave that room, they're going to have to put their mask back on to get back into society again.
Right.
Because they're going to either have to see other family members or friends that that are not comfortable speaking with them, or they have to do what is normal to others. And that's wake up in the morning, go to school, go to work, go get grocery store and present yourself as someone who's not grieving in the face of society.
Right. Bev, talk to me about funding and how you guys are supported.
Okay. We do get a grant from the state of Ohio. Even though we're national, we are eligible to get this grant, and it does help with some of the payroll, but we're a very small office. We only have 2 full-time employees, Sherry and myself, and then 3 part-time employees and very part-time just come in to help out a lot. So it's a lot of things going on here with very few staff members, and the reason being is because of some of the funding. The only other funding we would get is donations. Struggle to get, but you know, it does come in slowly, and we're able to keep going, and hopefully we will be able to keep going for a long time. But you know, a lot of families don't want to donate to Parents of Murdered Children. They would rather donate to cancer or something that they feel, you know, could happen to them, which brings up a point. A lot of people feel like murder will never happen to them because they feel that it happens to people where, you know, they're out doing something really bad, and that's why they get murdered, which is so untrue. Like Sherry said, her daughter was sleeping, you know, with her husband, and that's happening more and more. You know, you can't be safe in school anymore. You can't be safe in a Walmart. And, you know, people have to stop thinking that it could, you know, won't happen to them, because it very well could. I hope it doesn't. But, you know, you're not safe anywhere anymore. This country has become very violent, and it's, you know, almost a scary place. You know, and a lot of people have that myth that, you know, they were at the wrong place at the wrong time.
Right.
So, you know, I don't think school is the wrong place to be. I don't think home and bed is the wrong place. So, you know, people have to start understanding that that's not the case of, you know, most of the murders. Most of the murders are domestic violence anymore, mm-hmm. you know, and that's, you know, become very, very strong thing to say that, you know, murders are happening everywhere, every place. So, and the other thing I just want to touch on is like Sherry was talking, the bond is so strong between families, you know, that when they've had someone murdered, they can connect because they feel like they know each other, know how they feel. That's why our conference each year is so important. A lot of people call it their family reunion, and that's why they have to attend. You know, maybe their husband doesn't want to talk about their loved one anymore, so they feel they have to come to the conference and be with other family members, so-called family members, so that they can talk about their loved one and get their grief out. Everybody grieves in different ways, and it's so important to be able to grieve, but there's no right or wrong way to grieve. You just have to, you know, muddle through it. However you grieve is the right way for you. Going back to funding, it's very, very sporadic. We just struggle and hope for the best and keep on struggling.
Sure. And part of what I want to do is try to, you know, some whatever small way I can with our audience is help you in that regard. There is a Please Donate Now button on the website, and the website is POMC.com, which simply stands for Parents of Murdered Children.
It's POMC.org.
Oh, I'm sorry. POMC.org is the website. So, and I'm assuming that if anybody is so disposed to try to volunteer either with you guys there in Cincinnati or at a more local level, then they can go and click on that chapters tab and contact a local chapter if they chose to do that. Am I correct in that assumption?
Sure. They can contact the chapters anytime. We have them all listed. Also on our website is some of the programs we have that I just wanted to mention. We have a murder wall that travels with us to the conference, so families can put their loved one's name, date of birth, and date of death on the murder wall. It's 33 panels now, and then we display it at the murder wall and have it unveiled. It's just a very honorable way to remember their loved one. Sometimes they don't have a body to go to a graveyard to, you know, grieve, so they can put their loved one's name on the murder wall and see it at the conference. We also have a parole block program, which helps families when they're up for parole. Like Sherry said, you know, when her murderer comes up for parole, you know, we want to help in any way we can. So we have all of our chapters sign petitions to petition the parole board to not let them out. They've done a horrible, devastation crime to their family, and they don't feel that they should come out, even if it's 25, 30 years later. And they still feel strongly about that. They're afraid for them to get out. They don't want to see them on the street or, you know, feel that they might retaliate against the family. So there's, you know, the parole block program. There's a second opinion service program, which if a family feels that their loved one was died mysteriously and the police ruled an accident or an overdose and they don't feel that that's the situation, and that happens a lot with domestic violence cases. You know, we will look at the case. We have experts that will look at it and give their opinion on what they feel or what evidence they feel could be helpful or
some kind of answer to the family, or they may just tell them, yes, it was a drug overdose, or that's what their opinion is. So those are just a few of our programs that if people want to go on our website and look at those programs, and, you know, maybe somebody will need those programs in the future, it's something they can look at.
It's a great resource. I have told you ladies before we even hit the record button, I can't imagine a better group. I can't imagine a better place to go. I can't imagine better resource if indeed you are the parent of a murdered child. So I want to thank you ladies both very much for being on the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you. Yes. Thank you for getting the word out. That's one of our main purposes is, you know, now with technology, internet, people can Google and find us a little closer. But we've had people that have had a loved one murdered 10 years ago and said, oh, I wish I would have found you right away. But they didn't, for whatever reason. But, you know, now, you know, if we can get the word out to anyone out there that needs us, we're here for them.
Well, thank you. Few stories are as compelling and as demonstrative of leveraging the power of others like the National Organization of Parents of Murdered Children. I had hoped to record Bev and Sherry using a video conferencing call so that we could record both audio and video, but sadly, their office, like many nonprofits, is operating on a shoestring budget. They don't even have a computer with a webcam. A state grant from Ohio and private donations are their means of support. Their only means of support. I'd like to ask you to help them out. Help them out if you were so inclined. A few new computers would go a long, long way to helping these fine folks perform more effectively and more efficiently. Think about donating to them today. I'm thankful that you listened to their story. I hope that you have learned some things. I encourage you to visit their website if you choose to support them. I hope and I pray that you don't need them, and they do too, but you may know someone who does. And if you do, then please encourage them to reach out to POMC. That simply stands for Parents of Murdered Children, POMC.org. Well, that's it for me. I'm going to be gone the rest of the week. I'm traveling, so there will be no show on Wednesday and no show on Friday. I know I should have planned better, and I probably should have recorded ahead of time, but I did not. So I'm just going to be truthful and honest with you. Today's episode was brought to you by The Peer Advantage. ThePeerAdvantage.com is where you can find all the details, and you get it. You get it. You've already heard the conversation. It's about leveraging the power of others. What's our common tie? Well, thankfully, we are not all parents of murdered children, but we are all entrepreneurs, small to medium-sized business owners from around the United States, coming together by way of a video conferencing platform because, well, we do have webcams, that we can communicate with one another. We can share insights. We can share experiences. We can share our heartbreak, and we can share our opportunities with one another with no vested interest except to help each other because we all get it. Details can be found at thepeeradvantage.com. I'm searching for new members right now, and I'd love for you to apply, and that will prompt a phone conversation between us. All the details can be found at thepeeradvantage.com. The podcast can be found at growgreat.com and all of your favorite podcast catchers. My name is Randy Cantrell. Greetings and welcome inside the Yellow Studio. Until next time, be well, do good, grow great.